we have any votes?
Come to order. We were absolutely just waiting for that gavel. It just didn't make it here. Who was at the Thursday, January 7th? Representative Davids, were you there? And are the minutes to your approval?
I just love them. They're wonderful.
They are moved. Any corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Those minutes are approved. We're going to begin our higher education presentation with our first presentation from Matt Gehring, who replaces Kathy Novak in higher education. So we're happy to have you here and get to know you a bit. And welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. As Chair Hausman said, I staff higher education issues now this session. In light of Kathy Novak's retirement. What I'm going to do today is give a very, very brief overview and some context for HEPR and what that stands for, just to give you some background before you hear the actual capital investment requests from the MinSU campuses and the U of M campuses today. You should have in your packet a handout that's titled Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement HEPR Overview. It's a document that looks like this. This is what I'm going to be using as I go through the presentation today. So everything that I say should be printed on this handout for you to take with you as well if you'd like. So HEPR is the acronym that we use in state law to refer to Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement. This is a state statute that is specific to higher education, and it recognizes basically the uniqueness of the properties that exist both on MinSU campuses as well as campuses at the University of Minnesota. Particularly it recognizes that many of the facilities and sort of the physical plan of each campus has sort of unique needs and infrastructure needs that are different from other types of state agencies and other types of state properties, particularly in cases where buildings are very old or very or sort of aged and haven't had the maintenance that they need over the years to keep them up. So basically, this is a state program that allows funding for these projects for sort of deferred maintenance and other types of sort of updates that particularly older buildings and facilities need to keep them sort of up to date and current. The state statute was first enacted in 1994, and it recognizes, as I said, the uniqueness of the properties between the U of M and MinSU campuses, and it also recognizes the needs for sort of basic standards to kind of treat all these properties in a similar fashion for funding purposes.
So that's relatively recent, there must have been an analysis at that point that said it's not working the way we're doing it, or...
Right. I think that's correct. So in 1994, the legislature decided these standards were needed in statute. When they were first created, they were based on existing asset preservation programs that are currently in law for other types of state projects. So in Chapter 16A, there's a capital asset preservation system as well. This is a program that's specific to higher education projects only. In the statute, there are specific categories of projects that are eligible for HEPR funding. These types of projects include code compliance, health and safety measures, Americans with Disabilities Act compliance, abatement of hazardous materials, improvements to facilities for access and air quality, repairs to buildings or infrastructure as needed to preserve interiors and exteriors of buildings, and then as building infrastructure renewal to support the campus mission. In 2009, the legislature also added to this list energy efficiency improvements, so you can use HEPR funding to do sort of insulation, other types of things that would improve the energy efficiency of a particular building or facility. In 2002, the legislature amended the law also to allow 10% of HEPR funding to be used for design costs for eligible projects in anticipation of future appropriations for a specific project. So HEPR requests come to the legislature through reports from both the MinSU and the University of Minnesota boards. These are annual reporting requirements that you're required to receive by January 15th of each year. The board is required to set priorities for HEPR projects and then, as I said, report them to the legislature as well as to the Department of Management and Budget. The report is required to list all the projects funded in the previous calendar year as well as priorities for funding and their HEPR requests for the upcoming year. HEPR projects by statute are required to be the highest priority in capital investment projects for MinSU and U of M campus. So that's a separate provision of state statute that outlines these priorities. So HEPR requests can take one of several different types of forms as they come to the legislature. You might see a request that's sort of a system-wide full funding amount without specific itemized projects in a request. So you might just get a specific dollar amount for HEPA projects throughout the University of Minnesota system. You might also get a list of specific projects and specific sort of itemized costs for each campuses in the request that would have locations and dollar amounts and a little bit more detail about specific projects that are being envisioned. Or you might see HEPA funding as part of a specific project or project type in a request, and then that it sort of combines with other parts of an individual request. HEPA funding is a little bit different from other types of capital investment funding for university campuses because it's not subject to the one-third user financing portion that you'll hear about with other types of new projects or new buildings. HEPA, the legislature has traditionally not required that one-third match from the campuses in order to fund HEPA projects in previous bonding bills. And it is possible for the legislature to choose not to fund an entire HEPA request, so you might get a particular dollar amount from Minsky or the University of Minnesota for HEPA projects, and you might choose to fund only a portion of that. The one thing to be careful about if you do decide to fund only a portion of the request is that it won't always be obvious which projects will be funded and which projects won't be funded unless you specify specifically in the bill what exactly you want to have done with that funding. And finally, the last couple of pages, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about the numbers and dollar amounts, but I do have some charts that I worked with Mr. Lee in putting together for this handout just to show you the amount of funding by year for HEPA projects since the statute was first enacted in 1994. You can see at the bottom of page 2 the total amount from 1994 to 2012 for both MinCU and the U of M. If you add it up, it adds up to a total of about just under $775 million on HEPA funding since 1994. So it's a pretty significant chunk of money for these types of projects. The graphs on page 5 just show sort of the distribution of appropriations by campus since 1994. And these dollar amounts, I should note, are displayed in by biennium. So in recent years, there's been a trend towards doing smaller bonding bills on both years of the biennium, and earlier years, it's the tradition had been more to do one bonding bill at the end of a biennium, but to sort of display them accurately, we decided to just lump them all together into a particular biennium to show it on this graph.
The bottom of page 1, a separate provision of state law requires that maintenance and preservation be given the highest priority. As many years as I've been doing this, I did not know about that, and my committee administrator and I just both said we hadn't heard that before. That does seem sort of like I'm assuming that the legislature said, well, we want to take care of things before we build new, but to write it in law strikes me as a bit of micromanagement on the part of the legislature. I'm just thinking, for example, suppose there were a four-year institution. It's the only four-year institution in the seven-county metro area, and it doesn't have a science building. Might the system say, because of our mission and students, that's our highest priority, but they're not able to say that because of a decision we made. Do you know when we added that?
Madam Chair, so this is section 135A.034. It's a subdivision that specifically relates to capital projects. I'll read the list, and then I think this was an amendment that happened in 2000, if I'm remembering correctly. So the priority list is first, maintenance and preservation of existing facilities. Second is completion of projects that have already received funding. Three is updating facilities to meet contemporary needs. Four is providing geographic distribution of capital projects. And five is maximizing the use of non-state contributions.
So it does somewhat explain these graphs, the difference between 94 and 2000 and then following.
Right.
Hey, were you finished?
I'm just about so. Okay. Just I'm not going to talk a whole lot about the numbers that you see in the back page of this handout. This is just a graph that shows the percentage of funding in previous bonding bills for HEPA projects, as well as for overall funding and total project funding, and some other statistics. And because every bonding bill and every cycle is a little bit different, I'm not going to really focus on these numbers. But I just have them here for your reference in case you would like to take a look at them.
Questions? Yes, Representative Detmer.
This is just a question for the committee. On the second to the last paragraph, it talks about projects that have been paid for in the prior years.
And what page are you on?
In the first page, I'm sorry. In terms of providing a list of projects, list of priority projects of each system intends to seek, is that being presented to us?
We will be getting both of their HEPR lists today.
Okay.
Any further? Okay, thank you very much. And we are honored to have the Chancellor of MNSCU, Stephen Rosenstone, with us, and the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. We've come to know, we still think of you as new, but we're starting to develop good working relationships. We're happy you're here, and Chancellor Rosenstone, are you starting us off? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Hausman, members of the committee. I'm Stephen Rosenstone. I'm Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I think I get to be new for about another 6 months. Good morning. It's a great pleasure to visit with you this morning and to talk with you about our capital priorities for our colleges and universities. Understanding that there are a few new members of the committee, I want to provide a mercifully brief snapshot of our colleges and universities and talk a bit about our students to try to set a context, if you will, for our priorities. I'll then give an overview of those priorities very briefly and report on the execution of the projects that you helped provide during the 2012 legislative session. I'm grateful to this committee and in particular to you, Madam Chair, for the support you've given to our colleges and universities, our system-wide capital needs. On behalf of all of our students, I begin by saying thank you. After my comments, with your permission, Chair Hausman, I'll turn over the presentation to Brian Yolitz, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities, who leads both our capital investment prioritization process as well as leads the execution of our capital projects, and he'll walk you through the details of our priorities. Preparing Minnesota's workforce with job skills required by business and industry is our core mission. We deliver this mission by touching 430,000 students each year through our 31 colleges and universities at 54 campuses across the state. Our campuses are an integral part of the economic vitality of 47 communities across Minnesota, providing access to higher education and job skills training across the state. Our 850 buildings and nearly 27 million square feet of facility space represent roughly one-third of all the state's facility real estate. This is where the teaching and learning and job training happens. Many of you have visited our campuses and are deeply engaged in understanding our programs and needs, and I thank you for your time and interest that you've expressed through those visits. Over the past decade, demand for our workforce and job skills programs have soared. Enrollment is up over 18% over the past 10 years. Investment in our facilities is needed to keep pace with the increased number of students we are serving. More than 80% of our graduates stay in Minnesota to work or continue their education. We also provide customized training to over 120,000 employees each year, helping them to ensure that they're at the cutting edge of their professions and that they're able to keep their companies competitive. We prudently manage our operations. Over the past 10 years, the real cost of educating a MNSCU student is down 10%. Productivity in terms of credit hours generated per square foot of facility space has improved 20%. And compared to similar systems of higher education around the country, we rank 37th out of 50th in terms of administrative costs. That's the kind of list you want to be at the bottom of, not the top of. Our colleges and universities serve roughly 58% of all undergraduate students in the state of Minnesota. We are the place working adults go to complete certificates, two-year and four-year degrees, as well as graduate programs. We are the place people go when they're displaced from jobs or when it's time to update their skills or retool and prepare for a new career. We are the place where businesses large and small go when they need training for their employees or simply need help solving problems. And this is why we are uniquely positioned to help grow the state's economy and why investment in our workforce training facilities is so critical to the state's prosperity. With that as a backdrop, our priority is simple: meet Minnesota's workforce needs. Our capital investments are focused on infrastructure needed to advance the workforce, both improve today's learning spaces and support the growing need for scientists, health professionals, engineers, precision machinists, technologists, and other workers in short supply. Our request falls into two main areas. First, as noted in the statute, our highest priority, essential repairs to protect our existing workforce training facilities, keeping them safe, efficient, dry, warm, and code compliant. And second, workforce skills gap driven projects to provide the necessary facilities to deliver to business and industry graduates with the skills required to meet their current and future workforce needs. The investment priorities are the result of a very rigorous prioritization process. Some of those priorities were funded during the 2012 legislative session, but there's unfinished business, particularly facility repairs met through HEPR, and we are bringing forward this session our most pressing priorities. And the timing of state investment in its facilities infrastructure is right, and there should be a sense of urgency. Minnesota's construction industry employment continues to lag other sectors of our state. Funding the priorities that we've brought forward to you will create roughly 750 jobs, and those jobs will be created statewide because our system is statewide. Financing rates have never been better and probably will never be better, and the big climate remains favorable, and funding early in the session means that funds will flow early, enabling us to gain one full construction season. And finally, we have a track record of rapid execution once funds are received. As an update on our execution, I want to share with you what we've done with the funds you provided before I turn the presentation over to Brian. This slide shows the status of the investments you approved last year in fiscal 2012. And you can see we are very effective in our execution. Implementation has been quick, immediately creating jobs and putting Minnesotans to work in communities across our state. All $20 million of the HEPR funds that you've deployed last session have been deployed to our campuses, and we're on track to having 100% of those funds encumbered by September. The $112 million that funded 21 other projects addressing workforce skills gap needs of business and industry are all under contract and moving forward, putting Minnesotans to work and preparing the learning spaces we need to meet the workforce needs of our state. In short, we are 100% on track with the funds you've allocated last year. With this as backdrop, with your permission, Madam Chair, let me ask Brian Yolitz to walk us through the details of our request.
Yolitz, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Brian Yolitz. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at the Minnesota State College and Universities. And thank you and good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities seeks state financing of $129 million to couple with $19.5 million of state system resources to execute a $148.5 million capital improvement program in our academic and technical workforce training spaces. This program represents the remaining priorities from our 2012 request. The capital program is made up of three elements: $90 million for HEPR needs focused on essential repairs and renewal of existing facility space and systems directly supporting workforce programs across the state. $49.5 million funds six major capital design and construction efforts, and $9 million funds 16 smaller projects bundled within three initiatives focused in workforce areas of science, technology, and math, or STEM, energy, and classrooms. In total, these projects represent deeper workforce training investment at 18 campuses within the system. The projects are shovel ready, meaning they're ready and poised to move forward the next phase of design or construction. We recognize that carpenters, electricians, sheet metal workers, painters, and equipment operators can't go to the job site until engineers and architects have done their work. Keeper is the top priority of our board. It has been since the merger, and I would argue even in regard to the statute. I think they've had the conversations that I've been part of always place it at the top of our list. It reflects the board's commitment to stewardship of the residents of Minnesota, and they are committed to taking care of the facility and infrastructure resources we have and the workforce training capacity it represents. The request is for $90 million to fund priority work through over 100 projects at all 31 of our institutions. Again, HEPA reflects the Board of Trustees' number one capital investment priority and targets urgent workforce training space preservation and protection. The priority HEPA investments will be focused on five broad categories: building and infrastructure, focused on roofs and the building envelope, on major mechanical and HVAC work, on code compliance, like Americans with Disabilities Act or ADA requirements, along with health and safety requirements, hazardous material abatement, typically asbestos abatement, and some workforce condition improvements, a couple projects focused on air quality. Over 90% of this investment is preserving existing facility infrastructure in the renewal and preservation of our facilities and the aging systems within those facilities, making them more efficient and effective and reducing operating expenses at our campuses. The balance addresses code and standard compliance issues and accomplishes advanced design of some more complex projects we intend on bringing forward in the future. The HEPA portion of our request may not be flashy, but it's critical to our campuses and critical to our students and the faculty that delivers the workforce training there. It's important to recognize that HEPA is much more about the it's much more than the buildings or systems in the project titles. It's about the workforce training and learning spaces they service and protect. HEPA is about protecting and sustaining workforce training capacity for Minnesota. To underscore this point, here are three examples of the many HEPA requests we seek to address. At Central Lakes College in Brainerd, the college seeks roughly $2 million to replace a leaking roof. This would replace and repair leaking roof elements and skylights that impact two computer labs, student tutoring center, large classrooms, the learning commons, mechanical room, and the library area. The design is done. Bids are ready to go as soon as funds are made available. Inverhills Community College needs $1.2 million to repair the cracking and deteriorated foundation of their business education building, which impacts many programs such as accounting, marketing, human resource management, and finance. The college is forced to scrape and paint on a regular basis because of the water infiltration issues, and if not kept in check, could cause health problems. Minnesota West at Canby requires $250,000 to re-side and insulate a technical building housing customized training and improving workforce development within a region. Just as our urgent HEPA work is focused on protecting and sustaining workforce training spaces, our nine major capital investment projects are focused on supporting the workforce and skills gap needs of Minnesota. This list reflects the Board of Trustees' priorities. While our facility spaces impacted by these projects represent education and training in an array of workforce areas, they predominantly address three major themes. STEM and allied health. Minnesota needs more scientists and engineers and medical professionals, including nurses, medical technicians, dental hygienists, radiologists, and respiratory therapists. DEED forecasts a 22% increase in these job areas over the next 7 years. These students need learning spaces to prepare them for the unfolding work environment of the future, and they need access to 21st century technologies, including labs for fabrication and simulations and physical science education. Projects at campuses in Bemidji, Eveleth, Grand Rapids, Moorhead, St. Paul, White Bear Lake, Montevideo primarily focus on meeting the STEM needs of the Minnesota workforce. Technical trades, including agriculture, construction, energy, manufacturing, and machining, are critical components of our economy. DEED forecasts the transportation business, truck drivers, mechanics, and repair technicians to grow by more than 2,000 jobs annually through 2019. Projects in Anoka, Canby, Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Jackson, Moorhead, Staples, and White Bear Lake, Montemita directly impact the technical trades workforce needs of these communities, as well as the workforce needs of their campuses. Finally, it's critical to provide quality classrooms and meet basic educational capacity needs. These spaces provide the foundation for higher education. Courses like math and writing prepare students for all fields. This important coursework also prepares students for transfer programs to advanced studies in supporting four-year baccalaureate programs in education, leadership, management, business, accounting, marketing, and economics, and much, much more. In addition, these are the spaces our regional partners come for customized training. Projects in Albert Lea, Ely, Invergrove Heights, Rochester, St. Paul, and White Bear Lake, Matamida, and Winona have an emphasis on improving classrooms and providing quality learning spaces for our students. Executing all these capital priorities will have a profound impact on our ability to prepare graduates to meet the most pressing workforce needs of Minnesota. In summary, our priority investments are focused on facilities and infrastructure necessary for preparing Minnesota's workforce. Our $148.5 million capital program seeks $129 million in state funds and financing, with $19.5 million from system resources to address essential repairs and workforce skills gap-driven projects required to deliver to Minnesota graduates with the education and skills required to meet their current and future needs. We are committed to being very efficient and effective in the execution of these projects, quickly creating jobs that put Minnesotans to work in local communities throughout the state. Now is the time to do this work. These priorities remain from the 2012 program. The financing, job, and construction climates are right. The sooner the funds are available, the sooner work can begin, jobs filled, and workforce training areas protected and enhanced for Minnesotans. We thank you for your time and attention this morning, and we're ready to answer any questions you may have.
And then we just want to call attention to one additional handout in your packet, which is your list of keeper requests. So if we were able to fund the entire $90 million, the six pages show the institution, the campus, the building name, the project title, and the request.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And you find that in your packet. And members, just to underscore, so all of the requests they're bringing us today, they actually requested last year. These were not funded. They carry over from last year for those not funded. So questions of Minskew. I did misspeak. We have the new request, Representative Detmer, but we don't have the requests here. They spoke to how they spent the HEPR funds and that those are expended, but we don't have a list. I'm assuming that probably went to MMB.
Madam Chair, we provided our list, basically a snapshot of those projects that were funded last year and the execution of those individual projects. That we noted that we would be bringing to the committees this list, and it's important to understand that this list, I think my colleagues in the University of Minnesota noted that they had some issues this evening, and when I get back to my office, I expect some phone calls about issues associated with the cold, weather-related, potentially. I may go out on a limb on that. But there may be some adjustments that may need to be required, but this is where our list stands today.
Representative
McNamer. Madam Chair, all these projects are bid out. Am I correct on that?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamer, no, they are not. They are
where will they
ready
bid
to
out?
Go to the next. Once funds are made available, we'll put an RFP out to and execute the construction work or next phase of design as needed.
In other words, we have not always been generous to them. We've not always funded everything, so they can't commit until we actually commit.
My question is if the bids come under their request, what happens?
Madam Chair, Representative McNair, what happens on a major capital project, those funds may be made available for HEPR work on the individual institution. I think that's in statute. On the HEPR projects, the smaller projects, we move that money around to address other needs as they come evident. Just as some projects may come under bid, we have been on the other side of the bid process and had some bids come in high and had to move some money back and forth. But that's within the HEPR realm.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor or testifier, could you tell me, you know, the list is here, obviously, that we have in front of us. Are they prioritized? I mean, this is in alphabetical order. You know, are they prioritized? And what's the criteria for prioritization?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, this is a list that helps manage. Each campus has got their number one priority. We try to focus on those, and then as funds are available, we try to continue down the list. Should less funds be made available, we'd have to go back and readjust this list to shrink. And our criteria focuses first on code compliance, where we've got an impending fine or enforcement action. We don't have any of those right now. But then after that, it's about our operations of our campus, the age of the facility condition, as well as other code compliance issues that may not have an enforcement action associated with them, and then some energy efficiency stuff.
And Representative Ward, we have often, if we say we're going to fund at $60 million, we ask them for a list. If we funded at $60 million, what would we cover? So they are usually able to provide that for us if we fund at a lesser level. So, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, so it depends upon the amount of funding that we provide to you as you go back and you check your list and then prioritize it from there or whatever. I was visiting with President Lundblad yesterday. And I have personally witnessed the, you know, when you talk about, Chancellor, I think you said one of the criteria was to remain dry. And I'm pretty sure that's what I heard.
Yes, sir.
And you know, I think when a roof leaks, obviously that's problematic no matter where it is. But in particular into a library, it's very problematic. And so I've seen that, and any kind of roof repair members or leaking or, you know, water damage kind of thing is significant, obviously, to whatever institution it is, and no matter if it's a classroom, a gym, or a library. But I would encourage all the members of this committee to touch base with your local community college to actually, you know, go and experience and witness and observe the project firsthand. And because when you... when you do that, then it really does give you a good basis of knowledge and information on being able to make a good, solid judgment here. So I just pass that on.
Good advice. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor Rosenstone, for coming to the committee today. Appreciate your efforts and the detail that you guys always put together with your requests. And actually, my question was very similar to Representative Ward's, with the prioritization of HEPR across the system. And can you talk a little bit about how the legislature might see that? You've got a lot of campuses, you've got some competition between the campuses for projects that you like to encourage, but how that communication might happen with the legislature about what those prioritizations and rankings might be. As Chair Hausman said, that if you got a 100% HEPR requested and satisfied, obviously we would know. But some of those are big hunks, and some of them are tiny pieces. Can you talk a little bit about the process between the campuses or how that communication might take place with the committee and with the legislature over time? And Mr. Yolitz might want to talk a little bit about that as well.
Who wants to handle that one?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, we've got the communications lines are open at all times, quite frankly. Within our facilities team, we've got program managers that focus on regions of the state, and they are engaged in the operations of the individual campuses. So they're in tune with the facilities, the requirements at each of those facilities. And what happens is we'll make a call for HEPR list, and we've got a pretty substantial backlog. Our facilities are about 60% of our facilities are over 40 years old, built in 1975 or prior. So we'll take a look at the individual priorities from the campuses. We'll talk with the program managers so they have a sense of across from campus to campus the urgency of comparing one campus to another, and they help us in generating a priority between their individual institutions. We integrate all four of their inputs to a list reflective of the monies that are available. That's what's represented in the list you see before you today. And we do the same process should the committee ask for what would happen at $60 million. We do the same kind of thing, take this list, validate what the conditions are on the ground at the campuses today, review those with our program managers and the campuses, and then reduce the list. We've gone so far as recommending some projects be parsed out. We've got some major projects. One of our campuses has several steam tunnels. I think it's like an $8.5 million total requirement. But quite frankly, if you look at the HEPR investment over the last couple of years, we're not able to do that all in one fell swoop. So we've asked the campus to break it up in individual chunks and prioritize which leg, if you will, of the steam line is more important, steam tunnel. So that's roughly the process that we follow is in terms of developing the HEPR list.
Follow-up? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess Representative Ward and Representative Dean now are both on the topic that I'm concerned about. Look over the chairs here. But it's on prioritization again. You know, I remember 2 years ago that Ridgewater campus had a high priority, somewhere in the top five or whatever. And I'm just wondering, and you've kind of gone through the process, but when do you feel that we will be able to know what your priorities are? I mean, how long will this take?
Madam Chair, Representative Riddle, these are our priorities today that are in front of you on the list.
So
this is the list. Should we get, should the system get $90 million, this is the project, these are the projects we would address with that funding. Now, should funding levels be anticipated at a lower level, oftentimes the committee would seek what would that list look like to help members understand where that would be. And we'd be able to turn that list in a matter of maybe 48 hours to get you a sense of if, for example, we could fund $70 million, what would it look like and what projects would fall off and which one would remain. And that would be a task on us to deliver for you.
All right.
And we are always able, when we pass that bill, to actually hand out a list on the House floor like this at the level we're funding so that you know exactly which campuses it's going to.
Chair Hausman, with your permission, prior to producing this list, there's a very rigorous scoring process. It is not a political jockeying within the system, but rather a scoring process by the professionals that help identify the most pressing needs. And so there are many other things that one could do, but these are the things we really need to do. And as Mr. Yolitz suggested, stuff happens. We fully expect that we're going to hear from some of our campuses over the next week about things that happen as a result of the drop in temperatures. Things happen when there are natural disasters that we just have to respond to. And we always want to be in a position where there are these emergencies and very, very pressing needs where we have the flexibility to be able to jump in and deal with the emergencies to keep the facilities open. That will always have some impact on our priorities. But as Chair Hausman suggested, when we get to the point where we know the number we're talking about, we will share with you exactly which projects we'll be able to execute.
Paula?
Thank you, Andrew. Well, so it's kind of like my priority right now is being here at this committee meeting, but if my pipes freeze at home, that changes.
I suspect it might.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions. The first one, you commented earlier that this list reflects the number one priority of each campus. And so my question is, if you look at the needs system-wide, what happens if you have a campus that has two major requests that are in greater need than maybe a campus that just says this is our number one priority? You know, maybe a roof replacement that would be nice and number one priority on one campus, but another campus perhaps has two leaky roofs, just to pick an example.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, indeed we've had to make that call based on the needs of the total facility infrastructure that we have in place. We have had to make the call that says we're not going to fund a number one priority at a campus because we've got more urgent needs at another. And our presidents, I think, understand that. And they oftentimes, I know they get together once a month and they talk about the woes of presidency, and so they're aware of some of the issues, and oftentimes say, "Yeah, my need is not nearly as bad as those guys." Thank goodness. And so we have had to fund more urgent projects at a campus, maybe two projects, and then not fund some at others.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that you make those adjustments then if you look at it system-wide. My other question, I'm a representative from the western suburbs. I'm looking here at Hennepin Technical College, and you have consolidated the projects up in Brooklyn Park, which is fine. There's three roofs that you've identified, or three roof areas. It's essentially one building. But then you go to Eden Prairie, and you've split them apart. And I'm wondering what the reason there is one leaking and one not, or because if you look at the total amount, you know, they're both significant projects at Eden Prairie, but you've listed them separately. And I'm just wondering what the reasoning for that is.
Representative Carls, it often has to do with the geometry of the roof structure and our ability to have smaller bite-sized chunks at times. And sometimes some of our buildings, they've been cobbled together over time, and they're kind of a Frankenstein. We've got to have a core building built at one time, an addition. So based on the geometry and the constructability of some of the work, we've broken them out into smaller chunks. Where sometimes there isn't an obvious line of delineation between roof surfaces, we've had to keep that in one big chunk.
Okay, Madam Chair, then going back to Mr. Chairman, didn't notice that she'd left. Then going back to your original comment that this list reflects the number one priority for each campus, it would appear Hennepin Tech Eden Prairie has two priorities on the list.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, indeed, there are several projects, several institutions have multiple campuses and have multiple number ones on the list. If that's maybe not your question.
Well, I'm just trying to get clarification what number one means, but kind of reminds me years ago the University of Minnesota used to come in and say this is our number one priority for this college, and this is our number one priority for this college, and everything became a number one priority. So just curious as how you were defining it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, from a business perspective, each one of the campuses has an operating budget that affords maintenance and expensable items. From a business perspective, I look at this list, and there are a number of what I would regard as smaller requests. I'll just draw your attention to Bemidji State as an example for a request for replacing and rekeying exterior doors. Just from a standpoint of, would those not be included in the overall annual budget for that institution, as opposed to coming to the legislature and asking for a capital expenditure? I'm just wondering where the prioritization for the budget on an annual basis for the institution, as opposed to a CapEx type of request.
Would that be the chancellor, or?
Oh, we could certainly try, Chair Houseman. This is not the total of all funds spent by our colleges and universities on their facilities. The funds we're asking help for under the HEPR law. There are additional funds that are self-funded out of their own operating budgets, and many of the daily maintenance kinds of things that occur on our campuses are not brought forward to the legislature under HEPR requests, but are actually paid for by our colleges and universities. We have an opportunity under the law to bring forward a request under the HEPR designation. We have done so. But there's also additional work that the individual colleges and universities are doing out of their operating budgets each year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then the understanding is that this was not considered as part of the normative budget for that college?
But Chair Houseman, my understanding is that this is something that is consistent with the HEPR law and therefore could be brought forward as a request to the legislature for funding.
So it's our way of partnering. It's the state's partnership in the capital issues. Do we have any further questions? I think we have. I think think we've answered all questions. Any concluding remarks you'd like to make?
Chair House, members of the committee, thank you very much for your attention on this brilliantly wonderful Minnesota morning. We look forward to working with you over the next several weeks as you craft a bill. If there are questions like the ones that we've begun to address with respect to HEPA prioritization and the like, we look forward to responding to them. And thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. And now we have the University of Minnesota, and we have a couple of other new faces who are joining us for the first time. But we also are joined in the audience by one of the regents, Dean Johnson, former state senator. I've asked him if he wanted to say anything. I think he's here just to hear his institution's presentation this morning. So we have Pamela Wheelock, who's vice president for University Services, relatively new, and will introduce herself to us for the first time. And we're joined by a few other people, the head of mechanical engineering and some interns. So we'll have them introduce themselves as they come forward. But Ms. Wheelock, I believe you're starting the presentation. And what we have, members, are three handouts from the university in your packet. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. And let me also acknowledge the thanks and appreciation of President Kaler, who unfortunately is out of the state today and regrets that he can't be here, but would welcome the opportunity later in the session to appear before your committee if that is conducive to advancing your work. I also want to acknowledge another of our regents is here today, Regent Tom Devine, in addition to Regent Dean Johnson. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today to share our 2014 capital request. And much as you've heard in your previous presentation, we really want to start with grounding this request in our mission. As Minnesota's only land-grant research university, our mission really is threefold: research and discovery, teaching and learning, outreach, and public engagement. The University of Minnesota, with our nearly 70,000 students, our 25,000 employees, our five campuses, our extension offices, and our research and outreach center, reaches all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. Our five campuses, Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities, in addition to 16 regional extension offices and 19 research and outreach centers throughout the state of Minnesota, reaches those individuals through the programs engaged in on those campuses, our research and outreach activities, cultural, athletic, clinical, and youth development programs. We directly impact millions of Minnesotans annually. The U is unique among Minnesota's more than 30 public and its two dozen or so private nonprofit and for-profit institution, and being the only public land-grant research institution. Last fall, we enrolled 44,000 undergraduates and 18,000 graduate and professional students on our campuses, with another 7,000 non-degree students attending classes at the University of Minnesota. We award about 14,000 degrees annually, delivering to the state some of the best qualified, critically thoughtful, highly skilled, and curious talent in the nation. Those degrees include 90% of Minnesota's STEM doctoral degrees, 85% of Minnesota's MD degrees, and 100% of Minnesota's dentistry, pharmacy, and veterinary medicine degrees. Our researchers attract about $800 million in funding to our state each year. That puts us eighth in the nation among public institutions for research funding. That's remarkable considering our state's population is the 21st largest in the nation. This research funding, mostly from federal research organizations such as the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation, supports about 16,000 jobs annually in Minnesota. Our economic impact, our partnership with the state of Minnesota, is critical to the health and vitality to this great institution, our University of Minnesota. We provide an exceptional return on investment. For every dollar the legislature and the governor invest in the University of Minnesota, we return $13.20 to the state's economy. That's a 13-to-1 return on investment for every dollar. Besides being an exceptional investment in what we discover in our labs and in the human resources we develop, we are also stewards of our precious physical assets. And I'd like to add, we are extremely thankful to the legislature over the year for what the legislature has provided over the years to the University of Minnesota. We could not deliver our programs without that support, and we are confident that we have used those investments wisely and made good investment decisions.
And members, this screen, I think, is a helpful indication of return on investment, lest we think the bonding bill is just about the state spending money. There is, in fact, an economic impact on that from that investment, and I think it's helpful for us to be aware of that important screen.
I want to particularly mention most recently your bonding that helped construct our innovative and student-focused science, teaching, and student services building, STSS, and that is helping us as we begin to see our new physics and nanotechnology building taking shape in construction. Of course, our Biodiscovery District, a $292 million partnership with the state of Minnesota to provide close to 500,000 square feet of medical research facilities, was approved in the 2008 legislative session. I'm proud to say that the Cardio Cancer Center will open later this fall, and we are in design for the last of the BDD facilities, the Microbiology Research Facility. As a brief reminder, the program specified four buildings, the first being the 120,000 square feet Wallen Microbiology Building, which focused on brain disease and was completed in 2009. The second and third buildings of approximately 300 square feet of space was undertaken simultaneously as a single project called the Cancer and Cardio Research Building, housing the Lilly High Heart Institute and the Masonic Cancer Center. That building will be completed this spring and ready for occupancy by this summer. The fourth building has a research focus on infectious disease microbiology and is currently in the design phase and expected to be under construction in 2014. Occupancy of that building is targeted for 2016. Our capital request emerges from a six-year capital plan process. That plan, approved by our Board of Regents, who are elected by the state legislature, includes projects that have been prioritized with consideration to alignment with the strategic academic priorities, a facilities condition assessment, our campus master plan, and a financial and debt capacity analysis. The projects that we are advancing this year in the capital request have been thoroughly vetted. They strategically advance our academic research and outreach mission and are financially sound. Our requests have survived rigorous examination by both our staff and our regents. I have advised that the most recent cycle of examination of potential capital requests from the academic and research units within the university amounted to roughly $2 billion of capital investments. From this vast array of needs, we use a systematic and rigorous approach to set priorities. Our request is pointed and purposeful. Let me take a few minutes to walk you through the specifics of each project in this year's request. We have advanced a $172 million request that includes seven key initiatives that touch on all aspects of the university's mission and its importance to communities across the state. I just want to remind you that relative to our presence in the state, we have roughly 29 million square feet within our institution, and that's five unique campuses, 19 research and outreach centers, and 16 extension field offices. Our HEPA request. The University of Minnesota is home to more than 850 buildings on those campuses, and compared to all other public entities, the University of Minnesota's facility inventory includes the oldest buildings. While 70% of the buildings across the system are more than 30 years old, the more significant challenge from a financial and physical condition context is in reality about a quarter of our buildings are at least 70 years old. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with 25% of our inventory at least 70 years old, we are managing close to 7 million square feet of antiquated building systems, exterior and interior materials of all types, usually designed for a vastly different use and occupancy than currently exists. Mm-hmm. Hospital rooms have been converted to offices, clinic space converted to labs, dining halls renovated to accommodate teaching and learning spaces. Those are just some of the examples that you find on our campuses. To fulfill our academic mission and graduate students who are ready to work in today's high technology, business, research, and productive and production environments, our facilities must be cutting edge. We simply cannot train tomorrow's generation of workers in yesterday's laboratories and classrooms. Recent data shows that the university has demonstrated its ability to deliver HEPA-funded projects in a timely and efficient manner. We have spent close to 100% of our allocation from the 2009 and 10 legislative sessions, and 2011 is at 95% spent or encumbered. Our information shows that 6 months after the 2012 legislative session, we have spent 22% of the 2012 HEPA's allocation. Projecting forward, we expect that number to be 55%. By the end of June, and 98% by the end of this calendar year. We take pride in doing the renovation and replacement work funded by HEPA because it represents stewardship of university assets. We feel that HEPA projects on the campuses are an excellent example of a good investment for the return generated in value, timeliness, and effectiveness. To extend the useful life of our vast infrastructure, we request $125 million for HEPA. This request will support over 100 projects on our five campuses and through our research and field stations. As we prioritize HEPA-eligible projects, we target projects that improve safety and accessibility, extend the facility life, and improve energy efficiency. In this way, our HEPA request is about much more than bricks and mortar. Those investments are critical to strategically reducing operating costs, leveraging external research funding, and enhancing student success. And Madam Chair, I believe you have the HEPA request itemized in your packets.
And my understanding is because of an incident over the weekend, there's already a bit of a change in it looks something like this, but
Madam Chair, this is a fluid, dynamic process, and yes, we did have a unfortunate water issue in one of our buildings on campus that we are in the process, even as we speak, about cleaning up and trying to restore to some usefulness. The material you have before you references our identified HEPA projects for this year's request. Three examples from our intended project list that I'd like to share with you today are the Mechanical Engineering Building on the Twin Cities campus, Heller Hall in Duluth, and Bemler Hall in Morris. Heller Hall in Duluth is the home of the Department of Geological Science and the Department of Computer Science. It was constructed in 1965. And is situated in the middle of Duluth's campus. It is located at the midpoint of some of the primary circulation corridors that link Duluth Student Center, which is the Kirby, with STEM classroom destinations in the building. We are assessing the project cost at $9.2 million for Duluth Heller Hall in 2012 dollars. Mechanical engineering was built in the late 1920s. It fronts onto Church Street on the east bank of the Twin Cities campus, and space within mechanical engineering is used for student labs and research labs. Renovation of building systems and exterior enclosure is required to improve operating costs, address code deficiencies, and accessibility issues. Project cost is estimated at $30.5 million in 2012 dollars. In Morris, Bemler was constructed in 1918 and served as the hub of residential activity when Morris was the West Central School of Agriculture. As Bemler was the kitchen, dining room, and two-story gymnasium used by the School of Agriculture for multiple academic and recreational purposes. It's located on the historic quadrangle at Morris and is considered a key element of the campus's built environment. The building has been the subject of numerous renovations over time. Currently, the heaving and mechanical systems are close to the end of their useful life and require significant upgrades. project cost is estimated at $670,000 in 2012 dollars. And we have some specific projects that you have either seen before or are priorities on our six-year plan and will be coming to future legislatures for requests for funding partnership. Eddie Hall, built in 1886, Eddie Hall is the oldest building on the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus and is a contributing element of the old campus district and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1984. The building was originally designed to house the mechanic arts programs, including mathematics, drawing, civil, municipal, structural engineering departments, as well as testing laboratories. In 1903, an addition was added to expand the building. Many departments have occupied the building in a key location of the old campus or Knoll district, but physical conditions such as accessibility, HVAC, structural aging, contributed to its depopulation over the last few years. The building is now vacant and awaits renovation. The renovation of Eddie Hall will result in a new home for the International and Transfer Student Admissions Program. Eddie Hall is an easy-to-find, high-profile location that will provide a more attractive first impression for international and transfer students. Currently, the International and Transfer Student Admissions Program are located in the underground Williamson Hall, which is inconvenient and difficult to find for first-time visitors' campus. Relocating transfer and international admissions near the Freshman Welcome Center in Jones Hall will centralize new student services in one of the university's most historically significant buildings. Renovation of Eddie Hall will create approximately 20,000 square feet of office and student service space, add fire safety features, and provide major structural repairs. As space is made available in Eddie Hall, other units will vacate obsolete space in other buildings on the Twin Cities campus. Eddie Hall is the first step in a series of events required to achieve broader goals for more efficient space utilization and management of the campus space inventory. We are committed to making the university a welcoming place for international students and transfers. In 2011, the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus served 2,046 new transfer students and 2,357 international undergraduates. Those numbers are forecasted to continue to grow in the near future, and an adaptive reuse of Eddie Hall will preserve the best elements of the campus historic fabric by making it accessible and intensively used by those new to the campus. With this project, we can demonstrate the rich legacy and the exciting opportunities that we believe are available at the University of Minnesota student, University of Minnesota for those incoming students. The St. Paul Campus Laboratory investment. This project will fund the design of the first component of the St. Paul Research Laboratory Improvement Program anticipated for the 2014 and the 2016 capital requests. The broader goal of the St. Paul Research Lab investment is to match specific research activity to the buildings and labs best suited to support that work, and repurposing and decommissioning the space that is least suited to research use. There is approximately 500,000 square feet of laboratory research space on the St. Paul campus. Three colleges, the College of Biological Science, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, and the College of Veterinary Medicine are the predominant users of the space. The theme of the new facility will be food production and safety, infectious disease, meaning plant and animal, and bioremediation. Comparative analysis of the building condition or the deficiencies to lab condition or the suitability to needs of the current research and occupants indicates that there are serious problems with the age, condition, configuration, and infrastructure deficiencies. Optimized use of research space is constrained by these issues. And most significantly, the physical configuration of a great deal of the St. Paul campus lab space is not able to adequately support current research practices. The predominant need is for wet labs that support biological and chemical methods in basic science research. This type of space requires complex building systems, mechanical and plumbing, and are essential to support protocol-driven science that mandates controlled environments and managed procedures and operations. Over the past 5 years, enrollment in the three colleges has shown steady growth, and faculty changes resulting in net additions have increased demand for lab bench space. The colleges anticipate continued growth in faculty hires in the near term. Diversification in current wet lab space is important given the age and condition of St. Paul Research Space inventory. The objective is to accommodate about 30 research leaders and their teams, which comprises approximately 150 to 200 people in total, in the new space and improve lab conditions in existing space for as large a population of researchers as possible. We expect this population will be drawn from current faculty and future hires as well. The project will be driven by the ability to construct new facilities which could approach 50 to 60,000 gross square feet of new space and then renovate as much space as possible and decommission the equivalent of the amount of the new space built. The Tate Laboratory renovation, at nearly 200,000 gross square feet, Tate has been the home for physics since its construction in 1926. In 2011, a new physics and nanotechnology building began construction, and many of the labs currently found in Tate will relocate to the new building, leaving Tate with an obsolete systems infrastructure, outdated labs, and teaching facilities that do not provide an optimal learning environment. In addition, Tate is considered a contributing element to the Northrop Mall Historic District. We are asking for funds to initiate design of a complete renovation of the Tate Laboratory building for use by the School of Physics and Astronomy and the School of Earth Sciences. The existing Tate building will continue to house the physics and astronomy program as well as consolidate the university's program in geology, geobiology, hydrogeology, geology, geochemistry, and geophysics, programs which are now located in 5 separate buildings on the Twin Cities campus. The overall objective of the investment in the Tate Laboratory will be to create labs and lab support spaces that advance research endeavors in the earth sciences, as well as create teaching spaces that elevates the student learning experience. As we begin to design our programs for renovation, we intend to complete a sensitive, adaptive reuse of the building that results in exceptional interdisciplinary STEM program facility. The Crookston campus, the Wellness Center, anticipated the growth in residential presence and recognizing the need for the Wellness Center as a focal point of student life and integration into the campus community, Crookston made the Wellness Center the top priority of its 2010 campus master plan update and of its 2012 six-year plan submittal, which was approved by the Board of Regents in March. The existing recreation and fitness facilities are not sized to accommodate the campus population, which has grown considerably in its residential component over the last 5 years. Currently, there are about 1,600 students and 250 staff on the Crookston campus on a daily basis. Access to and the ease of use of these recreational and fitness facilities is seen as essential to recruiting, retaining, and graduating students. The size of the proposed addition, about 55,000 square feet, is anticipated to include recreational space, fitness facilities, as well as additional program elements such as classroom and a potential admissions and welcome center. Advancing the project in one year is expected to result in cost savings from avoiding construction cost escalation. Now, the original recreation facility was built as Knutson Hall. The building to its immediate east is called,
Lysaker.
Thank you. Lysaker Gym. Use of gyms is heavily scheduled in the two facilities as they are shared between both the athletics team, there's a Division II team, and recreational users. Competition for the use of space is significant depending on the season and the related level of intensity for use by the varsity student athletes. Two significant renovations in the 1980s and the early 2000s remodeled key spaces in Knutson Hall building for use. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, keep in mind that in 2005 there were approximately 1,000 enrolled degree seeking students and about 150 staff associated with the Crookston campus compared to today. Academic studies have shown that involvement in communal experience, residential, dining, recreational sports is an important ingredient into the integration of students into the social fabric of the institution. Social integration is defined as participation in activities with peer groups, and this integration improves a sense of commitment and really improves the tenure of the students and the ability to retain those students until they complete their degree.
This is a new request, and just to sort of a follow-up on Representative Albright's earlier question about to Minskew, what is the institution's responsibility? We, for example, don't do dormitories because the assumption is students pay, there's a revenue stream, and that's how they can build and maintain it. Mm-hmm. And the question that occurs here, again, this is relatively new, so I don't know the detail, but assuming that some of these recreational and wellness activities would be fee-driven, maybe they aren't, one needs at least to ask the question, is it possible that this building would be more like the dormitories, where there's a revenue stream that that supports it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, my colleague Fitz has joined me because you make an excellent point, and I think there's something distinctive about this particular campus request. So, Fitz,
welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter. I go by Fitz. I'm the CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that life, I was an employee of the House of Representatives up until 1992. On the fiscal staff, so for those folks in the that work for the legislature, it's a great experience. I spent 10 years at it, and I at times miss it, although I get to come back every year and talk to you. In answer to your particular question, Madam Chair, I think the challenge on some of these smaller campuses with both recreational facilities and housing projects is, for example, at Crookston, the undergraduate population is only 1,802 students, and to take the entire cost of a project like this and put that on the students on the campus through a recreational fee or into their housing rates does become quite a burden. We look carefully at which projects to advance. At Crookston, we have put in some new housing, and the institution itself has, on occasion, came forward and helped on that cost because there just isn't the critical mass like the Twin Cities campus where you can spread that debt service. So that's really the reason this particular project's here. It's just too small a student base to put the entire cost of the project on.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, would this facility be available to the general public besides the students?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're certainly looking at that. There's an excellent example of that at Morris, where there's a joint opportunity. I will tell you we have to be a little careful about that, simply because if we do go down that route, there are private use issues when you issue tax-exempt debt. In this environment today, the difference between taxable and tax-exempt debt is pretty small, but it is something we keep a close eye on.
Follow-up?
Madam Chair, at Morris, that project brought the community together, made Morris a big part of the campus. But I think maybe the community might have shared some of the costs of it. I'm not real sure on that.
Are you familiar with that?
Madam Chair, members, I believe the community did share in some of the cost.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding student fees, now we have a university system. Are the student fees for each campus just for that campus, or does it spread out to the system?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the student fees are specific to the campus.
Okay. And Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, Fitz makes a valid point. When we were dealing with student fees being part of a project on the Twin Cities campus, it was one number. But I remember when we were dealing with Morris, it was a different number, but they did participate to some degree. But we recognize the fact in the case of Morris, there were a couple thousand students, where you have a much larger base on the Twin Cities campus. So we would adjust the number accordingly.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct.
Okay, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move through our remaining slides fairly quickly in recognition of the time, but I do want to talk about a couple of additional proposals that we have as well. We have received funding from the legislature previously from the state for a research laboratory improvement fund, and this fund focuses on the replacement of obsolete facilities associated with the emerging field of study, particularly related to the critical food safety and environmental as well as energy challenges. This fund will be administered a little bit differently than last time. We have used a competitive system-wide approach previously, but we also learned a lot in the process, and we know that we have two critical needs. One is to replace the university's existing bee research facility in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resources Sciences, and the other is to replace the obsolete greenhouses in the College of Biological Sciences. And then the remaining funds will be used for system-wide for targeted strategic investments in research space that really would not be able to be addressed but for the funding that would be available here. Just a couple of comments. The Bee Research Facility is led by a MacArthur Genius Award-winning professor at the University of Minnesota who is currently conducting cutting-edge bee research in an antiquated building that has numerous systems deficiencies. A new facility will remove that constraint with poor quality space and building infrastructure, and that investment will further her research into the bee-related issues associated with pollination, which, of course, is an important issue not only in food production but specifically to an agricultural state like Minnesota.
Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Wheelock, I totally agree about the importance of that for the Research Laboratory Improvement Fund. I'm somewhat disappointed, though, that we have another critical issue in the state of Minnesota right now, research and development is a key component of aquatic invasive species, and we provided some money last session for the research center there, and I've seen it, and it needs some updating and some upgrading and some bonding money to make sure that the operation there is successful. And the aquatic invasive species, particularly in the state of Minnesota, is critically important to all of us in this state. So tell me why the U did not include some dollars for renovation of that research laboratory as well.
I confess a number of us went to see it and were sort of shocked at the condition given the level of importance that project has.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you can see that Brian Swanson is joining me here at the table as well from University Services and Mr. Mike Bertelson. I would say that I don't know the answer to where it ranks on the current list of priorities and whether it came through the last round of competitive opportunities. I know that we believe that these are two key priorities and recognize the importance of that investment as you were referring to. And I think we'll have to take under advisement your suggestion that we need to get more detail about whether that should rank higher on the list for research improvements.
Is Mr. Bertelson going to respond?
Mr. Bertelson, would you care to add anything?
Maybe just one bullet point. My name is Mike Bertelson, Associate Vice President for Facilities for the Twin Cities Campus. There's several stages of ways we're trying to address what you're talking about. One is within facilities, within the campus resources, we've made some renovations to the Hodson Hall fisheries already. That project just finished to make it much more functional. It doesn't make it great, but it makes it stabilize as it fun. And second is that there's resources that came through LCMR, and that project is kind of underway. The third component is a more broad perspective, and that's part of the same project referred to earlier, the St. Paul Labs. That's coming out of a
a broader review of all the research facilities on the St. Paul campus. We're imagining that's going to lead us to a stage series of projects for the St. Paul, both addressing biological issues as well as some of the more unique space, research needs like the fisheries that you talked about. So we are trying to address it in short-term, medium-term, and long-term perspectives.
And perhaps what we can do, because LCCMR was one source, but I think there may have even been a request that came through Legacy. We'll see if we can get a summary of what in other funds might have gone into that project.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. You speak to, under your background information, associated with emerging fields of study. Maybe I missed it. I don't think so, though. Are you just putting those towards the bee research and the obsolete greenhouses, or are there other fields that you would consider emerging fields of study under this $12 million request?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, the bee lab cost is estimated at $6 million, and the greenhouses are estimated at $4 million in 2012 dollars. So there would be a couple of million left for investment in system-wide opportunities, and so we'd have to look at that list and talk to the campuses about where those priorities would be for the lab improvements for the remaining $2 million.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I see she's got one more page. I wanted to revert back to an older
and
or
I
an
think
earlier
you have project. Actually a couple of people who would like to just say a word in support of the proposal too. So we'll try to squeeze it all in the next 7 minutes.
Madam Chair, let me just offer a couple of comments about the greenhouse before we move on. It's really outlived its useful life. Parts for the windmill systems are no longer available, and it's increasingly difficult to even try to repair this facility. So this project will consolidate all the greenhouse facilities into one complex and head house on the St. Paul campus, which also allows them for greater efficiency and higher utilization of the greenhouse facilities. So that grows and supplies plant materials for 12 of the College of Biological Sciences courses and supports 2,100 students annually. For the Active Learning Classroom Fund, this fund will advance the conversion of the traditional classroom learning space to the active classroom spaces throughout the U and extend the usability of the other active learning classrooms as well. With the opening of the STSS building, as we mentioned previously in 2012, the Twin Cities campus had a unique opportunity to provide a vastly different design and technology-equipped learning environment for consumption by our students. The 10 classrooms have been heavily used, and experience has amplified demand for more ALCs throughout the university. Incoming students seek out this methodology in all areas of studies, and learning outcomes have actually improved, and faculty have consequently challenged their pedagogies and curriculum to take advantage of the active learning classroom benefits. They're seen as desirable by both students and teaching staff, and the demand has just really exceeded our supply for this type of learning environment. In the Twin Cities campus, the Office of Classroom Management has identified key areas that are underserved by this type of classroom, and we know as well that the coordinate campuses have a desire to do this, and it's a particular priority for the Duluth campus as well. We could get into more detail along those lines should the members desire it.
I think we are going to, because we can always have you back for additional information, but I think we have three people who wanted to be able to talk about this, and we wouldn't want to bring them back, so if we could just have them come forward and at least get their testimony in, and if we need to have additional questions about the
content. Madam Chair, thank you for your time, and particularly
we
particularly ask members.
We may have you back, but we'll yep. We'll get that.
So joining us today are members from the Mechanical Engineering Department, which has both been a significant HEPR project in the past and a critical item, as you see on our priority list for this request.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would each identify yourselves for the record, we'll start with the gentleman on the right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Uwe Kortzagen. I'm the head of the Mechanical Engineering Department. It's my pleasure to just put a little bit of concrete example in front of you by telling you about our department and the specific HEPA request. The Mechanical Engineering Building, as you heard, is more than 65 years old, and according to a forensic study which was performed by RSP architects, all of the mechanical and electrical systems in the building are far beyond the expected life expectancy. I'm quoting that I would never talk about an expected life expectancy. This building has about 200,000 square feet, and in this building, which is more than 65 years old, we are running one, I might claim, one of the top mechanical engineering programs in the country. Just to give you some examples, we have 38 faculty members in the department, and these 38 faculty members graduate 200 bachelor's in mechanical engineering each year, around 40 to 50 master's degree, and 15 to 20 PhDs. Most of the bachelor's and master's actually stay in the state and work for companies in the state of Minnesota. The enrollment in our program over the last 4 years has increased by about 40%. Our PhD program is very highly ranked. In 2010, the National Research Council performed a ranking of PhD programs and ranked our program 7th out of 163 mechanical engineering programs in the country. I want to talk about economic impact and just give you two examples. First of all, our department has an operating budget, money which we receive from the university, of $8.9 million a year. You might be interested to hear that the 38 faculty in the department actually bring in $18 million of research money, external research money, per year into the department. The graduates of our department work in some of the most important companies in the state of Minnesota, like 3M, Cargill, Cummins, Donaldson, Medtronic, Boston Scientific. One fact which surprised me as well is that our department has around 11,000 alumni of which whom we keep track, and these alumni have founded 750 companies which have created a total of 60,000 jobs worldwide. Of those, 20,000 are in the state of Minnesota. So I would say that's a significant economic impact which our department has. Professor Susan Mantell is our associate head in the department, and she will talk to the impact of the infrastructure or the poor state of the infrastructure on our teaching mission. I want to give you one example of the impact on our research mission. In 2010, we hired a new assistant professor into the department. And in 1948, when our building was built, no one thought that mechanical engineers would actually need fume hoods. Well, this new professor needed a fume hood, and we looked through the building, and we could identify exactly one lab where it was possible to install a new fume hood. The installation of this new fume hood cost us $70,000 and 1 year of time to actually get this fume hood into the lab. And this 1 year of time is very critical for a young professor who comes in and has exactly 5 years to build their career in their probationary period. So this is just one example of how the poor infrastructure in our building affects our research mission. And with that, I would like to turn it to Professor Mantell to talk about the impacts on the teaching mission.
Ms. Mantell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having me here, committee members, and thank you, Professor Kortzagen. So as associate head, you know, as, in addition to being a professor, I do teach a course, a number of classes, but one in manufacturing where we have manufacturing labs, so I'm very familiar with the lab process for my class, and then also I work very closely with all of our faculty members who do teach labs, because in this particular building that we have some HEPA funds, like we are working on phase one right now, a number of all of our undergraduate teaching laboratories are housed in that building. So these would be required courses that our undergraduate students, all 200 who graduate, take a senior lab in a topic like heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, or they might take one, choose to take one on engines and learn how the engines operate. So we have five teaching laboratories in this building that we are asking for continued HEPR funds. I would like to just give you two very specific examples that recently came up in the last year. I would compare one. In this case, it was an electrical hookup, so we have a building that's over 65 years old. I would compare this to having knob and tube electricity in your house, something like this. We have a bus duct.
My house. What's going on with
that? Great. So this is a good example. Right. So we have a bus duct that runs that right down the center of each floor. It makes it very accessible, easy for us to hook up equipment. What we have found, though, let's say we wanted to buy, in this case, a new rapid prototyping machine. First of all, it needed a certain type of voltage, so we had to get a step-up transformer. Second, and this is the biggest problem that we have, is we actually have to go to eBay to find the circuit breakers so that we can connect the bus duct. When another building is renovated, we actually scrounge around and get their circuit breakers and put them aside, but if we don't have one that's the proper size, like 100 amp fuse, something like this, then we actually go to eBay. Sometimes we have to rebuild those. So this is really what happens to us, just to, not even to upgrade, but to install some equipment that really is not even state-of-the-art, but just basic equipment that you would need if you were going to prototype something for a design class or one of our student teams like Formula SE or Solar Vehicle might want to build something. That's an example of electrical. And just over Thanksgiving week, so fortunately it was a very short week, we were just painting a space on the third floor of this building. As part of that, we have some antiquated vacuum pipes that were capped off. And so the painters, and we had asked that we could take some of those down because they hang lower into the room. So the plumber came in, wanted to take one of those pipes down. Just a few drops of mercury came out of that pipe. It turns out that back in the day when we had a central vacuum system, if somebody had broken a thermometer that might have had mercury in, the most natural thing to do would be to vacuum it up in the central vacuum system. So in this pipe, this whole set of pipes that we have throughout the building, we probably have small, not major quantities of mercury, but small quantities. And all it takes, small quantity to drop on the floor, and it shut down all of our senior labs on that part of the wing for a week. Fortunately, it was Thanksgiving week, and no labs were scheduled because it was just a Monday through Wednesday, and we were able to get back up and running the following week, thanks to excellent support from our facilities group.
Dr. Korshagen, if you have your testimony printed, could we get a copy of that? There are some fairly helpful economic arguments.
Yes, Madam Chair, would be happy to provide you with
that. That I didn't
copy.
Note.
Yes.
Would appreciate that. Well, you have further comments?
One more.
And then we have a graduate student, I think, right?
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Korshagen.
Mr. David Bennett is one of our graduate students who works in our engine lab, which in 1948 the designers thought it was wise to have an engine lab on the fourth floor of the mechanic engineering building. In 2013, we don't think it's a good idea to have tons of fuel up on the fourth floor of a building, and that is a significant problem for us. So Mr. David Bennett is a graduate student in that engine lab, and he wants to talk about his experience.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm David Bennett. I'm still the oldest full-time graduate student in mechanical engineering. I'm here to give you an example of how our current infrastructure is in need of HEPR funds to address the needs of a 21st century engineering education. As I said last year, I returned to graduate school in 2009 to gain the theoretical know-how to design a fuel system. This fuel system is to utilize the newly discovered supplies of natural gas liquids, as an example out in the Bakken, to replace gasoline and diesel fuels in the upcoming generation of high-efficiency American light trucks being introduced. In fact, they're being introduced right now. Since last year's testimony, the university has filed two provisional patents for the key portions of that system. We will file four more this year. There are now three other graduate students working with me. The projected impact of this fuel system is the replacement of 50 million gallons of gasoline and diesel or diesel fuel per year
with a total of 250 million gallons replaced by the eighth year. However, I can't test even portions of the system in the building. The current building does not have the ventilation system or the safety constraints within the building for the kind of fuel that I want to evaluate. We don't even bother with testing engines, even diesel engines, in July and August because the heat and humidity in the lab compromise the data. The precision with which we have to measure emissions, it goes far beyond what we were dealing with even back in the 1990s. Furthermore, it is not possible to update one lab at a time because code requires that to make one change, we must bring the whole building up to code. I have been limited in pursuing funding for my project, mostly because I cannot test the system. The project is falling behind. We're the only ones in the country working on it, although it's being worked on in Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and China. HEPA funds will make it possible to bring the lab to the 21st century standards so that the new technologies can continue to be explored and young engineering students can be educated with hands-on experience in emerging technologies. Thank you.
Thank you. And could I also get a copy of that testimony, please?
Yes, ma'am. I can email that to you. I
appreciate that. I think it helps to set the context of our motivation for the bill. So thank you very much. I think we don't have any questions. If you've got concluding comments, otherwise, if we need to follow up, Ms. Wheelock, we can. Did I cut you off prematurely?
Madam Chair, no concluding comments other than to say that particularly HEPA makes an incredible difference to our ability to advance mission, and we appreciate what you have invested in the institution.
I think these last three testifiers were a nice addition to your presentation. I mean, they make real some of the lines on the budget. So
thank you for your time.
We thank you very much. No further questions. Meeting is adjourned.